This is the podcast of Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Leiden. It was a somber and reflective week in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. As the nation seemed to hold its breath, it occasioned a lot of conversations. We spoke with Muslim scholar Omid Safi about the reaction in the Muslim community and why it's been especially significant.
American Muslims are just as repulsed by these types of actions as indeed all Americans are.
A test of faith and American ideals. And a wheelchair athlete who ran in Boston has already completed her next marathon. That was Sunday in London.
The best way to fight against this terrible attack, I think, is to continue running marathons and keep doing what we love.
And a little on the lighter side, in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, 54 straight hours of trivia for fun.
They're playing for no money, as a matter of fact.
And for music, we hear from Nashville's Amy Spies and The Bard.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
We are the drunks and the dreamers, the criers and cheaters, the ones you'll find down on our knees. We are the fortunate ones. We are the fortunate ones. We are fleers and fighters, lying backbiters, begging against a reprise. We are the fortunate ones. We are the fortunate ones. We're the lovers and liars, starting small fires.
There's been a lot of speculation about the Tsarnaev brothers and the reasons behind Monday's bombing. The American press has made much of the suspect's Chechen heritage.
Reporting brothers from Chechnya. What does that mean?
Chechnya.
It's a Muslim republic.
What is the connection to Chechnya?
Ethnic heritage may have played a role.
But some of the boys' family have insisted it must be the American in them that inspired this, like their uncle speaking yesterday to reporters.
No, they've never been in Chechnya. It has nothing to do with Chechnya.
Julia Yoffe says the truth is probably a little of both. She, too, is a Russian immigrant. She left that country when she was 7 years old. Now she's a reporter for The New Republic, where she wrote an article yesterday called "The Boston Bombing Suspects Were Reared by Both Chechnya and America." She joins me now in our studios. Julia Yoffe, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So for many of us, when we heard that these young people were of Chechen descent, it was surprising for some people to learn about Chechnya's relationship with Russia. Explain to us how difficult that history has been.
It was part of the Soviet Union, and that's probably when the most bloody phase of their history was. The wars of the 90s and the early 2000s were a radicalizing experience both for Chechens and for ethnic Russians. Ethnic Russians now view them as an enemy inside their borders. On the other side, in the Muslim North Caucasus, it was a radicalizing experience because what was originally a quest for national independence quickly became a more internationalist Islamic insurgency. We should be clear that there really isn't much violence and terrorism in Chechnya now, and that is because of Ramzan Kadyrov, who is a hand-picked president by the Kremlin. He has people assassinated outside of Russia's borders that go against him. So he kind of holds that republic together. The violence and the terrorism has spilled over into neighboring Dagestan, which is where the Tsarnaev brothers spent a little bit of time and where their father is now.
So does that Chechen cultural background help explain the parents' belief that this was a government setup?
It explains more the mentality. So the Tsarnaev brothers' aunt spoke in Toronto yesterday. She said, this was a setup, this was a fabricated case. And I know because I was a federal prosecutor in Kyrgyzstan. And apparently the boy's father was also worked in the security apparatus. When you work inside a system that actually does fabricate cases against fellow citizens, I think like most people, they project what they know, the reality they know, onto the reality that they're now presented with.
But these young men were also in this country for a full decade. And although it seems that they adjusted very differently to the experience, Jahar, the younger brother, relatively well-adjusted by nearly every account from his friends and classmates. Tamerlan, a lot less so.
I know this in part from my own experience and from observing immigrants in the Russian community in the U.S., especially older people. The older people were when they came, the more they inhabit in their minds a world they left behind. A lot of Russian immigrants in the U.S. watch Russian television beamed in via satellite. They read Russian newspapers. They know about things that even when I was living in Moscow, I didn't know about. I would come home and relatives would ask me about ballet openings and new books that had come out, like things that living in Moscow I wasn't aware of, and they knew from across the ocean. So, you know, they inhabit this dual space where every day they're working and interacting with Americans, and they inhabit an American reality, but some part of them mentally is still there and probably inhabiting a place that doesn't exist.
As a Russian immigrant yourself, have you ever felt that sense of it can be difficult to connect even when you want to?
You know, I feel totally at home, totally American here, but there are certain things, you know, you grow up in a basically Soviet Russian home, and there are certain things that you don't quite understand about Americans, about how they will break down a check at a restaurant, like down to the nickels, and to a Russian, it seems very stingy. A Russian will go like, you know what, I'll get it. You get it next time. The funny thing is that I thought I was very Russian until I moved back to Russia at 27, and then I realized the problem that people like of my parents' generation have, who are more like the Tsarnaev uncle. They don't want to have anything to do with Russia. They're American now. They live here. But as much as they want to be friends with Americans, there's a limit to how close they can get because their whole frame of reference, their worldview is just a little bit different. You know, they read different books growing up. They watched different movies growing up. They have different jokes. They have different sensibilities. When I moved back to Russia, I realized that I was actually quite American and that people there were like, what is Seinfeld? What is Saturday Night Live?
That's Julia Yaffe, whose article, The Boston Bombing Suspects Were Reared by Both Chechnya and America, can be found online at newrepublic.com. Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you.
Omid Safi is a professor of Islamic studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's blogged about the Boston Marathon bombing and what it means to the American Muslim community and all Americans. Omid Safi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Now, when the news first broke about the Boston Marathon bombings, there were people who had the reaction, please do not let it be a bomber who is a Muslim. What were your thoughts when it was confirmed that the Tsarnaev brothers were Muslim?
You know, I think when I think back to Monday's horrific events, my first thoughts were actually to pause and to sit in grief. As it became clear that there were two suspects, and it's important to say that they're still suspects, that they have not yet been found guilty in a court of law, which is something that everyone deserves an opportunity in this country, that the two suspects are Muslims of Chechen background living in America, one of them apparently an American citizen. I think there were a lot of people in the Muslim community who were afraid and fearful that this would trigger somehow another wave of backlash against American Muslims. And in fact, you know, we did see that those fears were not unfounded. There was a Bangladeshi man in Bronx who was beaten up by people who called him an effing Arab, apparently confusing Arabs and Bangladeshis and Chechens. There was a woman, a mother, a Syrian-American doctor in Massachusetts who was walking her daughter in a stroller to a play date, and someone came up and punched her in the shoulder and said, F you Muslims, you're terrorists, you're the ones who made the Boston explosion. So, you know, we see the danger that there is once we come to conflate crimes committed by two people with an entire block of humanity.
What about the condemnations of these bombings by mosques like the Islamic Center of Boston, which ask people for sympathy for the victims, for people with information to come forward? Has this kind of outreach helped?
I hope that the Muslim condemnation of these atrocities have helped. I hope that they allow people to see that American Muslims are just as repulsed by these types of actions as indeed all Americans are. We saw Muslims in Boston, Muslims all over this country, condemn these attacks from Monday. And even today, we're seeing many mosques in Boston say that the brother who was killed, Temerlane Tsarnaev, will not be buried in Muslim cemeteries in Boston because he's not one of us. And I think that I hope that these kinds of actions will go a long ways towards demonstrating to Americans that American Muslims indeed share the same types of values about the sanctity of human life that all Americans do.
Do you think that we've learned anything from the racial profiling that occurred after September 11th?
So I would say that actually we have not learned anything, unfortunately. And one of the signs that we have not is that we still hear conversations about racially profiling Muslims as if Muslims somehow represent a race or an ethnicity. That just betrays a complete lack of awareness that, first of all, that's illegal. In this country, we identify actions and crimes, and we hold people responsible for their crimes, not for their ethnicity and not for their religion. And second of all, whom exactly are we supposed to be profiling and using what criteria? The two brothers that we are talking about in this case are from the Caucasus region. They are white for all practical purposes. Some Muslims, such as myself, are brown. And about a third of the Muslims in America are African American. So unless we're just going to racially profile everybody, the whole idea of racially profiling Muslims is absurd. And furthermore, it should be illegal.
Well, one of the things you point out in that blog is that in some of the other horrific incidents we've had of mass violence, if the perpetrator has happened to be white, there hasn't been a compulsion or a feeling that white people should try to distance themselves from an act of horror on the basis of race.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a kind of white privilege that when we have a situation like Adam Lanza or the
James Holmes and Aurora.
That's right. That's right. You know, we don't feel a need to necessarily identify all people who come from that same ethnicity as issuing collective statements condemning that attack. We simply call those people deranged, perhaps suffering from mental illness or what have you. Whereas in the cases where the suspects are Muslim or people of color, somehow there's this rush to expect all Muslims or Muslim organizations and institutions to come out and collectively condemn the attacks, which they indeed did. I'm deeply saddened that our religious faiths, which are designed to help us get closer to God, can be and have been and are twisted by some people to cause such an atrocious violence and hatred towards one another and to lead to violence. The Islamic tradition clearly and unequivocally condemns the shedding of civilian blood. Those types of prohibitions go back to the very teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran. So Muslim terrorists should be studied. But to depict them as somehow embodying the essence of Islam, which is exactly what Islamophobic websites are doing today, is actually to grant the Muslim terrorists the very legitimacy that they crave. And they don't possess this legitimacy, and they don't deserve it, and we should not confer it upon them.
Omid Safi is a professor of Islamic studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Amanda McGrory knows what it's like to have your whole life change in an instant. When she was just 5 years old, she came down with a rare disease that damaged her spine. One morning, she woke up and could no longer stand. Paralyzed from the waist down, Amanda adapted to life in a wheelchair. She turned to sports and today, at age 26, is a world-class wheelchair athlete. She's in London now, ready to race in tomorrow's marathon. Just a few days ago, though, she came in third at the Boston Marathon's women's wheelchair division, blissfully unaware of the tragedy that would soon unfold.
Last Monday was an absolutely gorgeous day in Boston. I've had a little bit of bad luck there in the past. It tends to be cold and rainy absolutely every time I do that race, so I was pretty excited that it was cool and clear. Things started off for me fantastically. Unfortunately, I had a bit of a crash at the 5K mark and came out of my chair and slid across the road and got dropped by the lead pack of women. But luckily enough, I was able to
chase back to them, make up some time, and finish third in the end.
And then these feelings of elation after this hard-earned achievement, then come the bombs. What were your thoughts then?
The bombing came to all of us as quite a shock. We finished quite a few hours before that, and we're already back in our hotel room. And I started receiving text messages from friends and family members asking if I was okay and what was going on. And because I'd had the crash during the race, I assumed that they'd all heard about that and were asking about me. So, being completely naive, I was writing back to everyone saying, oh, I'm just a little scratched up, everything is fine. And it wasn't until about 20 minutes later that we received a call with someone telling us to turn on the TV if there'd been an explosion at the finish line. And as soon as I heard that, my heart just sank.
Now, you and four other Paralympians are in London to race once more. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about competing so soon after the event in Boston?
Watching the response of the people in Boston after the bombings made me really proud to be a member of the marathon running community. To watch everyone come together to help the people at the finish line and to carry on was an amazing experience. Living in fear is a terrible thing, and the best way to fight against this terrible attack, I think, is to carry on and continue running marathons and keep doing what we love.
Now, a number of people have lost limbs. They will be relying on wheelchairs and prosthetics. I understand that you and your fellow racers have talked about using your experiences to help make people make this transition.
The transition from being an able-bodied person to a wheelchair user and amputee is always difficult. It's a long, long road paved with many obstacles. And while it's not something that a newly injured person wants to hear right away, I think that it is definitely helpful. It was incredibly helpful for me at some point after my injury to meet other people and learn that there were still things that I could do. I could still be an athlete. I could still go to school. I could still have a job, still have a family. And I think that I would love to help those people.
So you are racing tomorrow, and I'm sure that you're going to be in the athlete's frame of mind. I want to win. But anything else that's going to be on your mind?
I'll definitely be racing for those in Boston. One of my teammates, I think, said it best, that she was just blown away by the irony of everything, that we're at this wonderful event celebrating being alive, and it's so positive, and there's such a fantastic energy surrounding it, and for it to change so quickly into an event where people are losing their lives is just terrible.
Perhaps at the marathon, some of that fervor about its being positive and about its being the best of what people can do is something you can help achieve part of that mood and momentum again.
Running a marathon is a huge, huge accomplishment. It's a great test of the limits of the human body. And I hope that all of that positivity and all of that great energy comes out again on Sunday.
That's Amanda McCrory. She's a part of the University of Illinois track and road racing team. And Amanda, good luck. Thanks for speaking to us from London.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
On Friday night in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, thousands of people sat by radios and laptops waiting for this.
And now for question number one. At the beginning of a television show, fictional character Colt Seavers...
It's the world's largest trivia contest, and it's hosted by a college radio station, WWSP in Stevens Point. About 10,000 people from around the world are listening to a man who calls himself The Oz.
Fictional character Colt Seavers... took credit for making a particular actor famous. What is the first and last name of that actor? Good luck to you and your teams as you play in the world's largest trivia contest right here on 90 FM.
Trivia. Jim Oliver is the Oz, and this is trivia. Well, East Coast girls are hip. In fact, it's the 44th year of this contest out of Stevens Point, and it's not trivia as you know it from Jeopardy. This is trivia as in trivial. Minute details from things like
television, radio, commercials, music, books, comic books, and products.
And trivia. That's trivia.
That's trivia, exactly.
The setup is this. He reads a question, and your team, which can be any size, has the length of two songs to call in your answer. Some of the questions are pretty straightforward, like this one from the first hour.
A recording artist released a doo-wop song which went to the top 20 in the pop charts during the 1980s. He sang lead in all of the background vocals in the song. What is the first and last name of this artist?
Now, someone could conceivably know that one right off the top of their heads.
Whoa, for the longest time.
Yeah, someone like a Billy Joel fan. Now, that song is indeed apt. The contest continues for 54 hours straight. It won't end until midnight Central Time tonight. The hundreds of questions asked have been written by Oz and his friend, John Eckendorf. Let's face it, winters are long in Wisconsin.
And the two of us start writing the first Saturday in January, and we spend every Saturday afternoon and every Sunday night writing questions, all the way up until the contest.
The internet has made the contest a little trickier. Googling answers can be a problem, but Oz has made adjustments. Once, he might have asked something like, who plays Daryl in the movie Coming to America? In 2013, that question about the movie is tougher.
Just before the announcement of the engagement of big screen characters Daryl and Lisa, Daryl was at the bar talking with Akeem at the McDowell residence. What is the name of the song playing in the background? Good luck, trivia players.
Google can't help you ID that song. Oz takes it from here.
You find out, oh, it's in this movie. Okay, well then you move to your books, your notes, or the movie itself if you're lucky enough to have it.
Akeem, make sure everybody's glass is kept full. We're about to make a very special announcement.
Yes, sir.
What is the name of the song playing in the background? That answer is Pride and Joy.
And oh, the pride and joy as the questions get even more difficult. The Oz likes to ask things about advertising, taking from the stacks of old magazines he keeps in his basement, or details on an album insert from 1972. To win this thing, you have to be good.
It's dedication, it's taking notes. It's a way of life, really.
That's contestant John Okray. He grew up in Stevens Point. Trivia's been around for longer than he has.
It's just so weird when you grow up as a kid, you hear these questions and you think to yourself, how in the world are these people getting these questions? These guys, they have to be geniuses.
Okray played a little bit while he was growing up in Point, and now he's got a team of his own called Festivus for the Rest of Us. Most of us will know that comes from Seinfeld. He wouldn't give away much about their strategy. Trade secret, he says. But he says they rely mostly on notes, and throughout the year, they make notes on everything they can think of.
One of my shows this year is that new sitcom called The Neighbors, which aliens come down and are here on Earth, and it's absolutely brutal, but you know that Oz is going to ask a question from it, so you've got to take notes.
Festivus for the Rest of Us won the whole thing last year, and they've got a lead going into the final hours this year. As to the why, the Oz, Jim Oliver, says that's tougher to pin down. It's not like the teams are playing for big money. That'd be trivial.
They're playing for no money, as a matter of fact.
The top 10 teams receive nothing but a trophy and a congratulatory phone call from the Oz himself. The contest ends tonight at midnight Central Time, and if you're feeling curious or competitive, listen in at www.90fm.org.
Good luck. Right here on the little old 30,000-watt 90 FM.
We are the drunks and the dreamers, the criers and cheaters, the ones you'll find down on our knees.
This is singer-songwriter Amy Spies. It's a song called The Fortunate Ones, the first track from her new album, How to Sleep in a Stormy Boat. Now, this is one of those records that benefits from having a physical copy of it in your hands as you listen. None of that downloading stuff, because the liner notes are essential to understanding how this project came together. Amy Spies wrote each song based on a Shakespearean quotation, and on the lyric sheet, the bard provides an epigraph for each song he inspired.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
We are the fortunate ones, the fuel in this crazy machine.
Amy Spies is no stranger to Shakespeare. Before she embarked on a career in music, the stage called her name.
I wanted to be the Emma Thompson of my generation. And I went to Amherst College, and I was really obsessed with literature and the theater. And I ended up going to New York City right after I graduated and studied acting with the National Shakespeare Conservatory. We did a thing called Shakespeare in the Parking Lot.
Riffing on, of course, the great thing at the Delacorte Theater every summer in Central Park.
Exactly. Park. It was like the low-rent version, but it was really fun because we did it the Lower East Side in a parking lot in Delancey Street. And there was a drag queen that, you know, would rollerblade through my death scene when I was playing Juliet, things like that. So I taught myself to play guitar, and I had always been a musician and a singer but hadn't been a songwriter, but I always wrote poetry and plays. And somewhere in that period of time, something burst inside of me, and I started writing songs. And soon thereafter, I was playing shows in New York City, and I was discovered by Judy Collins, and she offered me a record deal. And then it was time for me to choose, so I kind of put away the acting and the Shakespeare to, you know, pursue the life of a folk singer.
And throughout this interview, we're going to hear from actors at Washington, D.C.'s wonderful Shakespeare Theater Company. We've asked them to come in. They'll read the quotation that inspired each song that we're going to hear. Let's begin with actress Erin Kopp in the role of Desdemona from Othello, and she's reading us into your song, Bring Me Back My Heart.
My mother had a maid called Barbary. She was in love, and he she loved proved mad and did forsake her. She had a song of willow, an old thing 'twas, but it expressed her fortune, and she died singing it. That song tonight will not go from my mind.
She sings herself to sleep when she's alone. Bring me back my heart. Bring me back my heart.
Wow. That just almost made me cry.
You're sitting there full of emotion. We're listening to Bring Me Back My Heart. How does the quotation relate to what you were writing?
I had played Desdemona, and I didn't want to write music to Willow, that song. That she quotes. For me, Desdemona is somebody who loves this man who just is treating her terribly. And there's something in there that she wants it to work so much that she's going to believe that this love is going to carry her through, even as he's killing her. And I had this image of this woman whose lover has left, you know, potentially maybe somebody who went off to war and died and never came back. Mm-hmm. And she was going to wait it out. My grandmother was somebody who she lost her husband in the first 10 years of their marriage, and she never met another man. And when she died at 104 years old, she died with his name on her lips.
Yeah.
I'm coming home, Bob. And I thought of her waiting her whole life to see my grandfather again. And I feel like that's where Desdemona is. So I wanted to write that song.
Wow.
She remembers every whispered promise that was shared. Falls to dreaming, repeating each one like a prayer. With beat she counts through fingers thin as bone. Bring me back my heart. Bring me back my heart.
So this is your sixth album, your first to draw on this Shakespearean background. Why now? You've been performing quite a while.
Yeah, it's always been in my bloodstream, but I think I was very intentional about keeping these two lives very separate. And then last year, I ended up losing my voice for about 2 months.
You lost your voice. Mm-hmm. Now, this had to be an incredibly disruptive thing. What happened?
It was terrifying. Honestly, I woke up one day and I couldn't talk. And it didn't come back, and it didn't come back. So I got under the care of a doctor, and it turned out to be a lot of stress. But I was told to be on vocal rest for 2 months, which, as a singer, that's how I make my living. And so I was going through this period of, like, what if this is it? What if I have to do something else? And in that time period, I just started reading a lot. For some reason, I had the collected work sitting in my desk, and I started rereading these plays. It doesn't mean that, you know, the voices inside your head don't go quiet when you go quiet. So some of my own lyrics were kind of coming back at me, and they were talking to some of these snippets of Shakespearean dialogue.
My guest is Amy Spies, and her new album is a collection of songs inspired by Shakespeare. It's called How to Sleep in a Stormy Boat. Let's hear another example. This is actor Nick Dillenburg, and he's playing King Lear. A few excerpts from that play, and they lead into the title track of this album, How to Sleep in a Stormy Boat.
Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow. You cataracts and hurricanoes, spout till you have drenched our steeples, drowned the cocks. When we are born, we cry that we are come to this great stage of fools.
Red sky ahead of the morning sun. And I've heard it said, that's when trouble comes.
Ooh, wow. This is just another really powerful piece. Why did you choose this as the title track?
I felt like it says everything. It's the umbrella. The whole record to me is almost like an old school navigation journal. How to get through something that seems so impossible to get through in order to survive and thrive. So, you know, I see this record almost like the stages of grief. Letting go of a love, or letting go of a life, or letting go of a dream, and then coming to the other side of it a better person for having gone through it.
Teach me how to sleep in a stormy boat.
It's not about the storm, and it's not about the water. It's really about the boat, the shell of the thing that you are that's raging. How to sit in grief and wait it out. Because it'll change.
Well, let's turn to one of Shakespeare's great tragic heroines, and that would be Juliet, Romeo and Juliet. And here again is actress Erin Kopp, and the song Hesitate.
Come, gentle knight, come, loving black-browed knight, give me my Romeo, and when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars. And he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
That passage, I love the end of that. He will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. I have bought the mansion of a love and not yet possessed it. That's like my favorite passage in Shakespeare. And Neilson Hubbard and I, the producer, wrote the song together, and I spoke these lines to him. I said to him, I think we need to end this record with this, whatever this is going to be. We have this idea of somebody just looking down on their life from the stars and knowing, you know, it's all going to be okay. And to me, the end of this record is at the end we have ourselves, and that's good enough. That even with all of this pain and joy, that in the end what we've got are our stories.
That's Amy Spies. Her new album is called How to Sleep in a Stormy Boat, and you can hear a few songs on our website, nprmusic.org. Amy Spies, farewell. God knows when we shall meet again.
Thanks for having me, Jenny.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
In my dream, I can fly above this house into the sky and look down on a little bed in a little room.
And that's it for the podcast this week. The people who put the show together are Phil Harrell, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Becky Sullivan, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical directors are Daniel Shukin and Rob Berman. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories from weekends on All Things Considered. You can catch us on Saturdays and Sundays on your local public radio station, or meet us right back here on the podcast. Until then, take care.
Ash and dust break the spell, like windows down in early June. Driving fast, I'll get to you.